صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
A move that has caused anger and outrage across France. The French President Emmanuel Macron has used his executive power to push the retirement age from 62 to 64. He says it is necessary to avoid the system from slipping into a deficit. Well, the French are not buying it. Such is the case with the opposition, which have filed two motions of no confidence in the government. Was Macron's move out of necessity? And how democratic was this move? Just two of the angles we'll be looking at in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce our guests. John Busnish, journalist, activist, and political analyst, joins us from Belgrade. Also joining us is Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst, who joins us from Brussels. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. John Busnish, I'll first start with you. We're looking at this reform, obviously, that you're well aware of. The government reasons for that, necessary to avoid the system from slipping into a deficit. That's what they said, which, according to the Macron's government, would put France in line with its European neighbors, where the legal retirement age is typically higher. Are you buying Macron's reasoning here?
Of course not. First of all, anytime you hear a government use the word reform, what they're actually saying is cutbacks. Cutbacks in services that they promised you, cutbacks in services that you already paid for. So the word reform is a code word for government failure. That's number one. Number two, a pension is a contract in which a person contributes money to an investment plan that the government monitors and guarantees for you, and that contract has two parties. No one party is legally able to cancel a contract without paying an indemnity. That's not happening in this case. So what's happened here is the French government has mismanaged the money that the French workers have introduced and paid into the system. And instead of accepting its mismanagement and cutting its expenditures elsewhere to cover the loss, they're trying to punish the people who properly, voluntarily, and in good faith contributed to the system. So any kind of pension reform, so-called pension reform, is called the real definition is government failure.
Okay, Elijah Magnier, what do you think about that? What we heard from our guest there, John Busnish, is that these cutbacks are things that the French have already paid for, and in particular what he said there at the end, that there's been mismanagement of money which is spent elsewhere. When it comes to pensions, that seems to be typical, correct?
Well, there is some of this, but there are much more element into this riots and manifestation that are happening in Paris and in other cities around France. So first of all, we have to understand that Macron has been elected by only 23% of the voters on the first round. And the French agreed to elect Macron because they were between a very bad choice and even worse choice between him and Marine Le Pen, and they didn't want to vote for the extreme right-wing candidate. This is already not giving Macron in the second mandate the majority at the National Assembly that he enjoyed on the first mandate. Secondly, there is the COVID that crippled the economy in Europe and elsewhere, and the decision of the European leaders to close down everything and then turn out that it was not the right move, that crippled the economy and the government needed to borrow money. France is under more than 8.9 trillion euros deficit. Another point is going to support the war in Ukraine and sending more than $60 billion from the European side, because there are another 60 from the American side. That also, I agree with the mismanagement of the asset, because not buying a cheap gas from Russia that used to reach us here in Europe with 30% less, and now we have to buy it, not only pay back the 30%, but also paying an additional four times the price of gas to America and Norway. That has crippled the economy, where the French government needed to compensate the individual, not the society, not the companies, but the individual, to a certain point that costed the government around 16 billion euros. So all these elements added to the pressure on the government that is saying, well, I need either to increase the taxes or to raise the pension age. And by increasing the taxes, the government will be faced with another problem, because the Americans have the gas that is cheaper, and because they are offering subsidies, we've seen the migration of many European companies and the big multinationals leaving Europe, going to the U.S. Had we maintained the price of gas and the flow of gas from Russia, there was a possibility to increase the taxes on the big companies and for these big companies to remain in Europe and pay the taxes.
Yeah, that last point that you made there, John Bustos, what do you think of that? It almost sounds, based on the fact that if you apply for a tax increase on these companies, that they would go the route that many have already from Europe, in particular from Germany, and those are the green rebates, so to speak, where U.S. has offered, of which, again, some multinationals from Europe have actually gone to the U.S. for. Was France left with any options other than raising this retirement age?
France has every possible option. They're running an immense deficit, an immense deficit. And that immense deficit is partly due to France's prioritization of maintaining its pseudo-empire. France continues to have military forces in Africa. France continues to try to project military power around the world as if they were still the empire of the Bourbon and Napoleonic eras. France has an identity complex, a political identity complex, and they have bankrupted themselves by trying to keep up the facade of being the France that they once were. Therefore, when they want to try to project power that they don't have, they take that power from the weakest members of their society. Those are normally the pensioners. And luckily for the pensioners, there are other elements of the society that are very upset now with the way the French government functions. And that includes the yellow vests. That includes the people who have objected to the COVID craziness. That includes the people who have read the reports that masks don't work. That includes the people who read the reports that the vaccines don't work, and so on. And so what we've got is a focus of all of these complaints on one spot. And the younger members of society are saying, why are we punishing these aged members, our parents, who worked all their lives in traditional jobs, many of them state jobs, where the government was not only profiting from your work, but also taking a pension fund deduction from your work. So they were profiting from you in two ways: the profit of the state corporation in which you worked, and the deduction from your salary for the pensions. The government has failed here. The French government has to cut back their military imperialism, and they have to use that money. Instead of making wars in Ukraine and making wars in Africa, they've got to use that money for their own people. That's the crux of the crisis in France. And Macron is nothing more than an American-led puppet regime in France. And the American system is to privatize everything when it doesn't work and let the poor suffer. That's their solution.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, one of the things that has angered many French, if you agree with it, Elijah Magnier, is the way that the and the manner in which this bill was approved. From what we understand, they sidestepped a vote in the country's lower house, and that angered many because not only does it put the notion of democracy into question, it's as if it puts Emmanuel Macron into this position where he rules, which many of those placards in the protest equated him with being a dictator. Isn't that also one of the sources of anger that's out there to have caused this controversy?
Is that a question for me?
No, that's for Elijah Magnier. I'm sorry, John. Go ahead, Elijah.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, using Elisabeth Borne, the prime minister, to use the constitutional clause 49.3 and to dismiss the vote of the parliament is due because Macron understood that all the Gaullists and the centrists will not support his vote, particularly with the people manifesting in the street. So using this clause is something that happened in the past at least 90 times in the history of France. However, it is a very unpopular decision. It is a legal decision. It is a constitutional decision, but it's not a democratic one. With that, I do agree, because he should have allowed the parliament to vote, but he has used his right. However, there are way out. I mean, I remember in 2006 when Jacques Chirac used also the same constitutional clause, and then he had to double down. But for that, there are consequences. And the consequences is either Macron is going to dismiss the prime minister after tomorrow because the prime minister is facing with the government the confidence vote, or he needs to dissolve the entire National Assembly and then later on resign because he knows that he's not going to get the majority because he has decided to take the road of a very unpopular decision to raise the age. Now, raising the age from 62 to 64, looking at it from the outside, particularly in Europe, Europeans think this is not a big deal because in other countries we have age of 65, 67, even in Italy, and they're thinking of pushing it to the age of 70. However, we see the advantage of the rich people or those who have gone to university and are educated, and they spend between 7 to 11 years studying, and then started to work at the age of 27 to 31, while the poor people and with a different background and different means, they've started to work at the age of 16 to 18. So by the age of 62, they have already done their 42 years and even 43 and 44 years of work, and they think this is not possible for them to work for another 2 years. Now, there is something in the French mentality that we need to understand, that the French take for granted anything that they have reached in the past. So in the past, the hours per week were 45, they were reduced to 40, and now they are 35 hours per week. And they're not ready to move and to work even more per week for the same wages. Now they have the 62 age of retirement, and they're not going to let go because there is a problem. The problem is the amount of wage we're getting on our pension, and that vary between 900 to 1,400. This is not enough to pay the rent and pay the bills. This is what the French and the other Europeans as well are facing,
sure,
with the wrong investment that Europe has made.
Okay, that's a point that needs to be discussed here, because we're looking at these protests, John Busnich, to have garnered some of the largest crowds. One of them was 1.5 million. And then looking at the opinion polls, just one of them, which actually mirrors many of the other opinion polls, shows that around two-thirds of the French people actually oppose this reform. Shouldn't the government be worried about not only the number of protests that take place, which really brings places like Paris to a standstill practically in terms of its economy, but also just in terms of the large crowds that are showing up? In the past few days, we've seen that it has turned violent, reminiscent of the Yellow Vest protests that took place.
Yes, well, in fact, the French government is obviously worried, and Macron himself is seriously worried, because he intervened to interrupt the democratic process, as your other guest pointed out, and rightly so. Macron is actually suspending the democracy that the French people fought for. They didn't just adopt democracy in France. They fought for it with guns, and they overthrew a monarchy, and they created a democratic state, which is far more democratically oriented than the United States, which was really a shift of power between ruling elites. In France, they made a democracy in which the people decided that, you know, we live once, and we want to work 35 hours a week so that they have the rest of the time for their family. They eat better, they socialize better, they have better music, they have better social interaction among themselves. That's a characteristic of French society. And when the French people say, you know, we'd like to live a little bit after our jobs end, and we want to live our, let's say, 15 years after age 62 until we die, and live those years with our grandchildren and with our families, that means something in France, because the family unit still exists in France, whereas in the United States, the idea of family has been destroyed by companies that take your son to California and take your daughter to New York, and you live in Missouri. So this is a cultural difference, and the French are in all of these demonstrations defending their essential identity, their culture, against the capitalization of their lives. And that's why this is an issue. It's not just an issue of plus or minus 2 years. It's an issue of freedom as defined by the French Revolution.
Yeah, they're very passionate about that. There's no questions there, Elijah Magnier. We've seen how the French come out almost... Well, at anything that they feel that they oppose in terms of any kind of government initiatives, and they come out in droves, as we have seen. But when you really take a look at some of these protests, especially the recent ones, obviously, it's not just about this pension reform, is it? I think you mentioned, Elijah, in your last statements, that this is also about what many European countries are grappling with, and that's a cost of living crisis, because it's not just about the pension reform. You said something about rent, which was 900 euros, I guess it has gone up to 1,100. But across the board, we're looking at increases in the cost of living, generally speaking, food we could also mention. Isn't that the case, that that's why this just added more pain to their misery?
It is. I mean, the prices today of food are really ridiculous. But every day there is an increase of prices. You can't believe that we pay for, I mean, I don't buy it anymore. I take a selfie next to it, but a kilo of tomato here costs $9. That is 8.5 euros. This is ridiculous price, and every day there is an increase. The rent is increasing. The cost of life is increasing. The value of the money is decreasing. It is no longer possible to live in this situation in Europe, and this is what the French are saying, and the other Europeans are saying. Well, even if we retire at the age of 62 or 64 or even 67, what's going to happen to us? The problem is now the Europe is offering a good health service that is giving more possibility for people to live longer. So they're not stopping to work at the age of 62 or 64 because the pension is no longer enough to survive and pay the bills. And all these decisions taken by Europe to see ourselves dragged into a war that falls in the interest only of the U.S. administration and nothing in the interest of the European population, this is something that Europe is going to pay the price. And the the price is we see today in the street, because France, it's a republic monarchy, it's not a democracy, that needs to be clear. People are starting to talk about decapitation of Macron. Well, because they bring back the memory of Louis XVI and the French Revolution. But this revolution, we've seen people in the street. You mentioned 1.3 or 1.5 million. The syndicate said there were 3.8 million. So these figures, okay, they're nothing confirmed, but between the Interior Ministry and the syndicate, there are millions in the street. There are hundreds of thousands in Germany. There are hundreds of thousands in Spain, in Greece, in Italy, everywhere. And it's not because of the pension only. It is not the Gilets Jaunes. It is also the investment that Europe is investing in the war for the U.S., on behalf of the U.S. And we continue taking decisions that are unpopular for the population, that are incompatible with the interests of the Europeans.
Sure.
And we are suffering the consequences, and we don't understand why. There is a huge gap between the leaders and the population.
Yeah, let's talk about that gap. But in particular, let's talk about the game plan John Bussenstedt Macron may have here. It appears that he's just trying to feel things out right now. He pushed the reform through, but he wants to see how things are going to pretty much transpire. I mean, the angle that I'm looking at here, you have different sectors that are striking, like the garbage strikes. We know has created havoc in the capital, Paris. We know in the energy sector, just the recent news on that is that the CGT union has said strikers would halt production at two refineries by this weekend or Monday at the latest. There was before a halt in gas production where we saw what happened. People were queuing up for gas. This goes back a few months. And we also know that there's a national train operator that's supposed to have urged workers to continue their strike. That's going to cause major disruptions. But if this spreads across different sectors beyond the ones that I just mentioned, wouldn't that impact the economy to the point where the French president may have to rethink of this pension reform? Is that a possibility? In 2019, the high fuel prices, if you remember that, Macron was forced into a U-turn on carbon tax. Do you think there's a possibility this may happen?
Absolutely. Absolutely. As soon as the strikes head to the health sector and to the educational sector, as soon as the teachers, as soon as the teachers stop coming out to teach the students and the students are staying at home, and as soon as a person cannot go to get medical treatment, then the system is finished. And Macron will have to resign. And it's just a question of the unions deciding if they want to take it to that level at this point. Do they have that level of public support? And I think it's pretty well understood. I mean, I studied in France for several years. I speak French. I read French media. And I can tell you that the French people are fed up, and a large proportion of the French people realize that their president is an American puppet, not just in the war on Russia, but in the way the economy is being transformed into an American-style command capitalist economy, not a mixed socialist and capitalist economy. And this is an essential attack on the culture of France. And Macron, if he keeps on pushing it, and he hits the school system, and he hits especially the medical system, then he's finished. And that, I'm sure, is what the unionists are organizing to provoke him into doing. Because Macron is going to do what he's ordered to do by the Americans, and the Americans have no mercy. And they will order him to do it, he will do as ordered, and he will fall.
Okay, unfortunately, we're fresh out of time, but thank you very much for that. John Bussenstedt, journalist and political analyst, and also Elijah Magnier. Thank you for your input from Brussels, journalist and political analyst there. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tapway and the team, it's goodbye.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll try to have a look at the commentary of Chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode. Now, please, let's listen to 187, 188, 190, and 191st verses of this very chapter.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
فَأَسْقِطْ عَلَيْنَا كِسَفًا مِنَ السَّمَاءِ إِن كُنْتَ مِنَ الصَّادِقِينَ.
So cause to fall upon us fragments of the sky, if you should be of the truthful.
قَالَ رَبِّي أَعْلَمُ بِمَا تَعْمَلُونَ.
He said, My Lord is most knowing of what you do.
فكذبوه فأخذهم عذاب يوم الظلة إنه كان عذاب يوم عظيم.
And they denied him, so the punishment of the day of the black cloud seized them. Indeed, it was the punishment of a terrible day.
إِنَّ فِي ذَلِكَ لَآيَةً وَمَا كَانَ أَكْثَرُهُم مُؤْمِنِينَ.
Indeed, in that is a sign, but most of them were not to be believers.
وَإِنَّ رَبَّكَ لَهُوَ الْعَزِيزُ الرَّحِيمُ.
And indeed, your Lord, He is the exalted in might, the merciful.
فَأَسْقِطْ عَلَيْنَا كِسَفًا مِنَ السَّمَاءِ إِن كُنْتَ مِنَ الصَّادِقِينَ. Therefore, cause a piece of the sky to fall on us, if you are of the truthful. قَالَ رَبِّي أَعْلَمُ بِمَا تَعْمَلُونَ. He said, My Lord knows best what you do. فَكَذَّبُوهُ فَأَخَذَهُمْ عَذَابُ يَوْمِ الظُّلَّةِ إِنَّهُ كَانَ عَذَابَ يَوْمٍ عَظِيمٍ. But they belied him. Then there seized them the chastisement of the day of shadow. Verily, it was a chastisement of a grievous day. إِنَّ فِي ذَلِكَ لَآيَةً. Verily, there is a sign in this, but most of them do not believe. وَإِنَّ رَبَّكَ لَهُوَ الْعَزِيزُ الرَّحِيمُ. And verily, your Lord, certainly, He is the Mighty, the Merciful. Now, this is when the story of invitation of Prophet Shu'aib comes to an end. The story of his invitation started from the 176th verse, where the Holy Quran introduced this prophet to his people. كَذَّبَ أَصْحَابُ الْأَيْكَةِ الْمُرْسَلِينَ إِذْ قَالَ لَهُمْ شُعَيْبُ أَلَا تَتَّقُونَ. They were the dwellers of the forest, أَصْحَابُ الْأَيْكَةِ, and they belied the messengers. And this is when the Prophet Shu'aib came to invite them to monotheism. First, he introduced himself as a trustworthy messenger. He ensured them that he does not ask any recompense for his invitation. And he started criticizing them of what they were doing. They were doing mischief. They were the mischief makers. They used to cheat and defraud people. But in response to his invitation, they headstrongly said, أسقط علينا كسفا من السماء. Send us your chastisement. We are not afraid of that. And he said, قال ربي أعلم بما تعملون. My Lord knows best about you and what you do. He knows best when you deserve to be punished. And as a result, كذبوه فأخذهم عذاب يوم الظلة. They denied him and belied him, and there seized them the chastisement of the day of shadow. إنه كان عذاب يوم عظيم. Verily it was a chastisement of a grievous day.
على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
So, as we said, their punishment was that they had 7 days of blazing heat that overtook them. They had nowhere else to turn to except for that piece of the sky that fell on them. That had a shadow, and they all gathered under that shadow. And then a fatal thunderbolt was created by that cloud, and it was accompanied with a very loud sound. And they were totally annihilated. At the end of this story, the Holy Quran reiterates the same things that were said at the end of the former 6 stories of the great prophets. The verse implies that there is a sign, that there is an instructive lesson in the story of the people of Aika and the kind call of their prophet Shu'aib, and their stubbornness, their headstrongness, and their obstinacies and rejections that led to their destruction. Inna fi dhalika la'aya. Verily, there is a sign in this. But most of them do not believe. وَمَا كَانَ أَكْثَرُهُمْ مُؤْمِنِينَ. Yet Allah, the kind, the merciful, gave respite to them sufficiently in order that they might change their way, in order that they might improve themselves. But when they deserved punishment, He seized them with His might. So the verse says, إِنَّ رَبَّكَ لَهُوَ الْعَزِيزُ الرَّحِيمُ. Verily your Lord, certainly, He is the mighty, the merciful. So, the last point that we think we can understand from these verses is that رَبَّكَ لَهُوَ الْعَزِيزُ الرَّحِيمُ, the verse says. An educator must be at the same time in the same position of power and mercy, the mighty, the merciful, both together. Thank you for staying with us, dear listeners. والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.ir. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parsetoday.ir/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavet, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
A scandal involving a Quran desecration at a school in northern England has continued to escalate, despite the resolution of the affair by the local community. With a local mosque and its imam facing a sustained onslaught by right-wingers in the press and government too. Hafez Mohammed Mateen Anwar played a prominent role in easing tensions after news spread across the community of a Quran desecration by students at Kettlethorpe High School in Wakefield. When the news went viral, talk of an alleged death threat and a street protest erupted. Mateen Anwar offered up his mosque to the school and police as a location for a community meeting, an opportunity to clear the air, lay out the facts, and end the matter once and for all.
Now, as far as the local Muslim community are concerned, the situation was dealt with amicably and ended on good terms, with communication playing a big part in making the difference. However, it seems as if the government and also certain right-wing elements within mainstream media appear to be deeply unhappy with the way the story played out.
The meeting successfully resolved the affair, with police, the school head teacher, and one of the students' mothers all in attendance. But instead of celebrating the peaceful conclusion, the British press ran with inflammatory interpretations of the story.
The police acted, recorded it as a non-crime hate incident, and the boys were, the four pupils were suspended. So that shows that we now have de facto blasphemy laws in the UK.
The mosque is now under investigation by a charity watchdog, while Mateen Anwar has been accused of stoking the row. He is also being portrayed as an extremist over Islamic views he's expressed in the past. Press TV spoke with the embattled imam, who blasted the media for peddling misinformation, such as forcing the mother of a student to attend and apologise.
What's the purpose of that meeting? The purpose of that meeting, Robert, was to let the community know that what you're seeing on social media, these lies, they're not true. Out of those students, one of their mothers, in fact, contacted our team on her own accord and explained how she felt. And she, in fact, herself invited our team to her home address by her own choice. The mother attended the mosque and wanted to sort of relate to the community about how she felt. A number of points were addressed on that meeting, which then led to a really amicable conclusion to this. There's a number of statements I've come across, statements from ministers, statement from the education minister himself, and a number of other political figures, people of media background, who have sadly just followed onto this tangent of lies and continue to progress that further without actually trying to investigate the truth, which is sad. It's really a sad reality that they've not actually investigated what went about. We were successful, Robert, in stopping a demonstration which could have led to further incidents. We were responsible for the reinstation of the children back into the school.
The imam added he's exploring legal options to challenge what he says is an Islamophobic smear campaign against him by right-wing elements who are deeply unhappy with British Muslims successfully standing up for their faith. Robert Carter, Wakefield.
The Israel Apartheid Week has started in Gaza and in many cities around the world. This is aimed at mobilizing grassroots support for the BDS campaign to isolate apartheid Israel in the global community, replicating the resistance movement against the South African apartheid.
The killing machine of apartheid Israel.
The week started with a message of solidarity to the Palestinians of the Gaza Strip from Mandela Mandela, the grandson of the South African leader Nelson Mandela.
We feel your pain and suffering and stand in solidarity with you in the struggle against the injustice and brutality imposed by the apartheid Israeli regime. We salute our heroes and martyrs of Gaza and the ordinary men and women, youth and children, who daily face the brutal killing machine of apartheid Israel. You are not alone.
As part of its events, the BDS chose to screen a movie about horror experienced by a Palestinian young girl during the Nakba. The ethnic cleansing of Palestinians by Zionists in 1948.
Well, I think the way Israel reacted to Farha is very typical of Zionist propaganda. They wanted to suppress the Palestinian voice. They didn't want us to tell our own narrative. And I think the best way of confronting this campaign of hate and racism is by producing more cultural products.
Palestinian institutions play an important role in informing people of the history of Palestine through different mediums in order to build a generation that is capable of reclaiming its rights.
I think that the new generation is passionate about learning the truth and the history of the struggle because during their entire life they have experienced both physical and structural violence perpetrated by the Israeli occupation. They want to know why they suffer, are not allowed to travel, and live in poverty. All this leads them to question the roots of all the problems.
The BDS movement has stressed the need to press ahead with the campaigns against the Israeli apartheid, especially because the regime has intensified its persecution to maintain a system of settler colonial oppression and domination over the Palestinian lives and land.
Recently, we witnessed a growing solidarity with the Palestinian people, especially when the new far-right fascist cabinet took office and Israeli massacre increased in the West Bank. We aspire to reach the international community, not only in the civil global community, to boycott, divest from and sanction Israel.
In Israel Apartheid Week, Palestinians reaffirmed their commitment to resisting occupation, exploitation, oppression and apartheid like any other people, by all means permitted under the international law and the UN General Assembly resolution, which includes armed struggle. Ulal Asi, Gaza.
On Thursday, a delegation of survivors and victims' families from last month's migrant shipwreck at Cutro in southern Italy met with the Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni and Foreign Minister Antonio Tajani. On February 26, over 80 people died after a rickety boat with about 200 migrants on board broke up in rough seas. 33 of the victims were minors, At least 16 people are still missing and feared dead. The shipwreck was one of the worst migration disasters in recent European history. No journalists were admitted at Thursday's meeting between Meloni and some of the relatives of the victims and survivors of the Cutro tragedy.
There must be a joint effort with other European countries when it comes to rescuing migrants in danger at sea. If the EU does not take concrete responsibility in governing the migration phenomenon, more tragedies will take place. Let's not forget that this massive influx of migrants began when Gaddafi was overthrown and killed in Libya in 2011.
In the past weeks, Italy has seen an increase in attempts to cross the central Mediterranean in a new shipwreck that took place about 100 miles off the Libyan coast. Between March 11 and 12, at least 30 migrants went missing and are thought to have died. The rescue operation was partially coordinated by the Italian Coast Guard. During a Q&A session in the lower house of parliament on Tuesday, Meloni and her government were accused of failing to offer timely assistance to smugglers' boats in distress and, in more general terms, of not doing enough to try and save people attempting to cross the Mediterranean Sea.
Not only Italy did its part, but it did it in an area outside its jurisdiction. The operation had been initially coordinated by the Libyan authorities.
Once and for all, Libyan authorities are not capable of providing safe and rescue assistance to migrants in line with international standards. The question here is if Italy is doing all it can to save human lives.
Since day one of its mandate, the Giorgia Meloni government has pledged to press ahead with an agenda aimed at stopping what it calls illegal migration. In January, the officials introduced a new code of conduct for humanitarian ships, making it much harder for NGO-run vessels to rescue migrants lost at sea. Lately, Rome has even tried to pass the buck on to others for the current Mediterranean migrant crisis. Earlier this week, the Italian government said the Russian private military company Wagner was behind the recent exponential surge in migrant boats from African coasts. The number of migrants reaching Italy's shores so far this year exceeds 20,000. Max Civili, Rome.
Chinese and Russian vessels have entered Iran's territorial waters to hold a joint maritime exercise in the Sea of Oman. Delegates from Pakistan and Kazakhstan navies will also be there as observers. China has dispatched a guided missile destroyer to the area, while Russia has sent a naval group that consists of a frigate and a medium sea tanker. At the first stage of the drill, the naval officers of the three countries reviewed episodes of the trilateral exercise on maps, received instructions, and held tactical briefings. Later, the naval commanders of the three countries held a joint presser. The Iranian Navy's deputy commander said the main aim of the joint exercise is to help safeguard security in the northern part of the Indian Ocean.
The northern part of the Indian Ocean is one of the most important maritime routes for international trade and transfer of energy. Therefore, providing security in combating piracy and terrorism requires cooperation among regional countries and allies with common interests in this region.
Meanwhile, Chinese and Russian Navy commanders said the joint exercise further demonstrates the preparedness of the participating countries to maintain security, and it will also deepen their practical cooperation. In an exclusive interview, Rear Admiral Tajuddini told Press TV that the trilateral drill helps protect peace and stability in the region.
The trilateral exercise of Iran, China, and Russia has a four-year-long history, and our goals are clear. Our motto is, together to provide peace and security. Therefore, we are only pursuing the interests of the Islamic Republic of Iran as well as collective interests of countries in the north of the Indian Ocean. We are cooperating with China and Russia in order to defend our interests and counter maritime piracy and terrorism.
This joint exercise is the third of its kind, following similar drills involving the Iranian, Chinese, and Russian navies in 2019 and 2022. The main stage of the Security Bond 2023 exercises will be held in the coming days and will involve forces from the Marine and Airborne units of Iran's Navy and the IRGC, as well as Russian and Chinese flotillas. Matia Bosian from the location of the drill.
Russian President Vladimir Putin held talks with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in the Kremlin. The head of states of the two countries are in constant contact as relations between Moscow and Damascus are developing in various areas.
Thanks to our joint efforts and the decisive contribution of the Russian armed forces, significant results have been achieved in Syria in the fight against international terrorism. This makes it possible to stabilize the socio-economic and domestic political situation. Unfortunately, the Syrian people faced another very serious problem, a catastrophe, an earthquake. This, of course, exacerbates the situation. As real friends, we are trying to support you. As you know, our units under the Ministry of Emergency Situations also worked here, and representatives of the armed forces stationed in Syria are also contributing to the fight against the consequences of the earthquake.
Meanwhile, Assad expressed support for Russia's special operation in Ukraine and thanked Moscow for its help following the earthquake.
This is my first visit since the beginning of this special operation in Ukraine, and I would like to repeat we fully support your fight against neo-Nazis and old Nazis. I'm talking about the old Nazis, because the West has always received them on the ground and now continues to help them. We support this special operation not because our countries are friends. Our position proceeds from the fact that the world really needs a stabilization now, otherwise it will come to collapse.
This visit has several important components. Syria survived a devastating earthquake with many victims. Syria needs economic help and assistance. Syria has problems with energy prices, which have risen. As an important ally of Russia, it will receive this assistance. The second component is no less important. A meeting of representatives of Iran, Turkey, and Russia at the level of deputy ministers of foreign affairs is to be held in Moscow, where a potential unfreezing of relations between Damascus and Ankara will be discussed. The very fact of such negotiations in Moscow already speaks of a positive trend.
The situation in Syria and bilateral military cooperation were discussed by the defense ministers of the two countries. Sergei Shoigu, in a conversation with his counterpart Ali Mahmoud Abbas, expressed condolences to the Syrian people in connection with the February earthquake and stressed the importance of close contacts, which are aimed at maintaining stability in the Arab country in the field of defense and the fight against terrorism.
The visit by the Syrian president is indicative of strengthening ties between the two countries. The Syrian-Turkish dossier is another important outcome of this visit. The near future will show whether this will lead to the restoration of ties between Syria and Turkey. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Out of classrooms and hospitals and onto the streets, tens of thousands of the nearly half a million striking public sector workers yet again calling for better pay and conditions. The biggest number striking over 2 days this week, teachers, 300,000 of them.
Schools are in crisis because of a lack of funding. There is not enough money going into the schools. It's not just about the pay for the teachers and for the support staff. It's about the basics in the schools.
This is the second time this year teachers walk off the job.
As part of the long-running wave of industrial action that has swept the United Kingdom in the past few months, today it's kicked up a notch in a momentous day of walkouts to coincide with the announcement of the budget by the country's finance minister in Parliament just down the street from here.
Among other things, Finance Minister Jeremy Hunt promised $115 billion in cost-of-living support for families. Ahead of the walkout, the teaching unions were asked by the government to call off their strike in return for formal talks. The unions said that was a precondition they wouldn't accept.
There's already enough barriers to us taking strike action. It's really hard to actually get a mandate to take strike action. We will talk if a decent offer is put on the table.
A decent offer is yet to be made. And in the battle of hearts and minds, striking workers are still winning, with health workers and teachers enjoying the most support. Primary school teacher Chris says the government has some political choices to make.
Teachers don't want to strike. I want to be in school. I want to be with my class today. So I certainly hope there won't be strikes, but there may be more strikes if the two sides can't make an agreement.
Cost of living protests and walkouts in the UK have been going on for months now, with strike fatigue nowhere in sight. Syed Purizza, London.
Several days ahead of the holy month of Ramadan, Kabul residents flocked to the city center to purchase food and necessities for fasting. Afghan markets usually witness a spike in food prices before Ramadan, but this year the situation is much more challenging. Many Afghan families are running short of food amid deepening inflation, unemployment, famine, and poverty.
Ramadan is a blessed month, and Muslims do their best to make full and special preparations. Unfortunately, this year, people are facing an economic decline with little purchasing power. They need rice, flour, oil, beans, egg, and dairy, but many will have to rely on a piece of bread and water this Ramadan.
I was employed only 4 months out of this entire year. I didn't have an income for 8 months. Today, I came to the city center to buy some food items in preparation for fasting the month of Ramadan. But as I saw the prices, I felt like I can't afford anything. The prices have skyrocketed and our cash has less value than before. I think this Ramadan will be the hardest.
This is the second Ramadan since the Taliban took power in August last year, following the catastrophic withdrawal of the U.S. The country's heavily aid-dependent economy, mostly funded by international donors, has been in chaos since the Western countries suspended humanitarian aid and froze Afghan assets.
We used to have an aid-dependent economy. After the political change, it started to crumble as the Western countries cut their aid. Furthermore, economic sanctions and banking restrictions were imposed on Afghanistan. This resulted in people losing their jobs and many factories and small businesses shutting down. In my opinion, the West is committing a crime against humanity in Afghanistan, pushing millions to starvation and death.
According to the United Nations Response Plan, in 2023, two-thirds of the Afghan population need humanitarian assistance. That's a record number of 28.3 million people. This will require funding of $4.6 billion, making it the highest humanitarian requirement in the world.
Ramadan is a month of celebration, unity, and compassion. But people in Afghanistan will mark the holy month under the shadow of multiple crises. They are awaiting solidarity and support from the international community. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
This is A to Z. An Introduction into Islamic Lifestyle. Today's lesson, Boarding. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In our today's subject, I will be going to talk about an un-Islamic behavior, which is hoarding. Hoarding means to purchase and store large amount of a product that creates shortage and scarcity of that product. Commonly, hoarded products include some assets such as money and gold, as well as vital goods such as fuel and medicine,